Tsunami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough.
This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me. I've waited long enough.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 423 of the Tsunami Escape podcast. My name is C. Kohler, and with me tonight is Seda.
Hello.
So I don't have a whole lot of news to go over today. The only thing I had written down was we did get a promo at the beginning of the block with Tom and Sarah talking about the upcoming music movie called Shin Bangumi by the band Ginger Root.
Yeah, I didn't see this. I knew this was happening next week, right?
Yes.
But I didn't see the promo. So
Yeah, my notes here say it looks very 80s Japanese. It looks like the footage that they showed makes it look like they're trying to recreate music videos or television that as it looked back in like the 1980s in Japan. So it's all like standard definition and like VHS quality and stuff like that.
And this video that they're doing is like an hour long.
Yeah.
I mean, with commercials probably, or maybe not. I don't know.
Probably with commercials, I think. Here's Crocodile. Looks like he's just joined us. Welcome, Crocodile.
Sorry, I had some stuff that gone away, but yeah, hello.
No problem. We figured you would just join us. No big deal. So we're talking about the Shin Bangumi promo that was shown that looks very 80s.
Oh, yeah, that movie. Like that. Though I mean, I had no idea what to expect, but I can certainly say that was not what I expected.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what to say. I mean, it looks interesting. I'm curious to see what it is. But I think it's a good sign that, you know, Jason DeMarco has always been a huge proponent of music and music videos being aired on Tsunami. And this is kind of one of the first ones they've done of this in a long time.
And I mean, usually the music videos we get, take place like in between shows or in between episodes, and they're maybe a few minutes. This is like a whole album or a significant, being a whole hour is pretty, that's unusual, but it's interesting.
Yeah, I really don't know what else to say about it. Other than, like I said, it looks like it's trying to kind of have the vibe of like of the 1980s Japanese television with the just the look of it and everything. And I've never heard of the band Ginger Root before. Although, I think I've heard their name before, but I don't know anything about them.
Me neither.
Yeah, I'm totally in the dark with regards to that.
Crocodile, unless you've got some other news, I think that's all I had.
Did you talk about that they actually aired the first Liquorice Recoil short?
No, we didn't mention that. That was on YouTube and on Crunchyroll, right?
Yeah. The only thing I would say
is I thought it was on YouTube.
I think I saw it on YouTube. It was, you know, Japanese subs, dub with English subs. The only thing I wanted to comment, it was cute, but certainly a lot shorter than I expected. I was thinking more of like 10 minutes or something, like an Adult Swim series episode was actually only about 2-something minutes, so. Mm-hmm. But it was cute. I mean, not much to say besides that.
Yeah, these are obviously very, very short. Okay, well, with that, let's go ahead and move on to Lazarus. Lazarus, Episode 3, Long Way From Home. So I'm starting to see a theme here where each episode, excluding the first one, sort of starts out with a character talking about their connection to Hopna. In the first episode, it was Leland, and now it seems like this episode, it's the voice of Chris, and she's talking about the reason she took Hopna, which was she said she thought it might, quote-unquote, cure a broken heart. And again, we get this image of a dreidel. Not sure what that means.
Of a what?
A dreidel.
I actually don't know what that is. Oh, the little spinning top thing. Okay.
It's a Jewish like ornament or toy, but it doesn't have some kind of connection to like life or something. I'm trying to remember my old Jewish folklore.
I don't know.
I'm probably
I know it's there. I know it does have like a religious thing to it, but I don't know anything more than that.
I was not aware of this. I always thought it was just kind of like an ornate top. I didn't know what it was called. I didn't know it was related to, you know, Hebrew or Jewish religion or something. I'm just looking up at Jewish spinning top is what Wikipedia calls it. Yeah, I was not aware of these.
The reason I'm aware of it is because I've always heard it as being a part of what's the Jewish holiday?
It's Wikipedia says it's played with during Hanukkah.
Hanukkah. Yes.
There's like multiple Jewish holidays.
It's a very common Hanukkah thing.
Yeah, the multiple Jewish holidays have a little more specific.
The big one, their version of Christmas. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah.
I've always heard it talked about there. Yeah. Anyway, so that's a very brief scene we see, and then we cut to back to the HQ, and Alana is showing everybody all these images of Skinner showing up everywhere, which have obviously been doctored and hacked, because we've got like the face of Skinner on like a bikini clad woman and other places like that. And she says there's really only three hackers in the world who could possibly pull off such a feat like this. One is named Popcorn Wizard. One is named Dr. 909. And the other is named Mad Screamer, which Alana says that's actually her. Her name is Mad Screamer.
These are such prototypical.
I have a feeling this character will be important later.
What'd you say, Crocodile?
These are such prototypical hacker names that it hurts.
Oh,
yeah. It's not a criticism. It's just like a comment. Just like, these are so hacker names, like, you know, but might as well have someone named Hackerman or something.
So Axel and Douglas are paired off to go on a mission to go find a lead that they have. This is a man named Claude Klein, who actually was Douglas's mentor when he worked at university. Apparently was a researcher when he was in his former profession or whatever. And this Claude Klein character, this Claude Klein guy who was his mentor, apparently knew Skinner when they were working together at university. Axel and Douglas aren't particularly keen on this mission because they don't seem to really like each other very much. Or in the very least, I would say Douglas doesn't like Axel very much.
They just have very conflicting personality types, so it's like a little bit oil and water kind of thing. But they'll get it. They'll.
Yeah, he's very laid back, and Douglas is very serious. Meanwhile, Leland and Chris pair off, and they're going to go investigate Skinner's house. They basically disguise themselves as like cleaners who've come to clean the house, and everybody, the cops and other people are like, "Don't you know what's going on?" Like. And they're like, well, you know, we've got this bill, and if we don't do this, we're going to have to charge you guys or some, you know.
This is a little bit silly. Like,
I agree.
There's no reason this should work at all, but I guess the plot needs to move.
Yeah. I gave it a pass because it looked like by the state of his house that it's obviously been ransacked and, you know, there's graffiti everywhere and stuff like that.
So vandalized.
It's been so vandalized. They probably don't really even care that much if they go in there. So.
Well, they do say afterwards that both, like, the police and other authorities have already gone through the house.
Yeah.
So, like, even still, they should not let strangers onto a crime scene or, like, a potential crime scene. But at least they didn't get there before the police, which have been kind of too ridiculous for my taste. But, you know.
Yeah. Although, while they're there, they're kind of looking around and they don't really notice anything weird. The pictures all show happy family photos and stuff like that. And I think it's... Leland or Chris, I forget which. I think it was Leland who just sort of comments, like, this doesn't really look like a bad guy, this Skinner. He just seems like a nice guy. And Chris sits down on the sofa. Her hand goes kind of between the cushions, and she sort of notices that she pulls out a pill, a small little pill. And I think Leland asks, is that Hopna? And she says, no, I don't know what this is. And then jokingly says, well, you think this is a cure to Hopna? And then that's kind of all we see with that scene. So I'm assuming they're going to take that pill back and examine it.
Yeah.
I will note that on the pill is the letter C, or at least that's what I saw, which is a little cute. We'll see if anything comes of that. But in the context of that joke, I thought it was a little funny.
Axel and Douglas arrive at this homeless camp because Axel says he knows somebody who might be able to find this Claude Klein. They learn that Claude has apparently fallen on hard times and is now a homeless person. And, Axel apparently has a connection with a guy named Jerry that he used to know. So he goes to this homeless camp looking for Jerry, but actually ends up finding Jill, who is actually Jerry is now Jill, trans character. And Jill's there, and she decides, hey, she's really happy to see Axel. And he's like, oh, yeah, I'll help you. I'll help you find this Claude guy. I've seen him around.
Mm-hmm.
Douglas is then led to where he finds Claude playing chess and sort of gives him like little tips on how to win. And, you know, he's like, that's when Claude recognizes him. Oh, Douglas, Doug, or whatever they calls him. And he goes into his little backstory about the fact that he knew Skinner as a researcher.
Basically saying Skinner was a very devoted researcher, kind of always hardworking, kind of very laser focused. And Claude basically says that he actually had to, like, in a sense of competition, in a sense, he felt he had to falsified some of his research. And that's what eventually led to him being kind of kicked out and where he is now. Yeah. Kind of like, this is my own fault kind of thing. It's not really painting Skinner in a bad light. He's just a very devoted person. So there's still this confusion or mystery about, like, why would Skinner do this? Because everything we see of him, like they said, I think in the previous episode, doesn't seem to lead to that. He doesn't seem like the type of person who would willingly put the world's population at risk. So there's right. that whole mystery there. But yeah. Then he kind of randomly, quite literally randomly, brings up the next clue that they follow.
Yeah, he basically mentions that he says, the only thing I can remember is that his grandma made the best baklava. And Douglas is, he's kind of like intrigued. He's like, what do you mean? He's like, well, you know, he had this grandma who lives in Istanbul, and she made the best baklava. And so...
And her name was Belinda. Like, he knew her name.
Yeah. Yeah. And so Douglas is like, okay, well, this is somewhere. Oh, by the way, and during this whole scene, Axel goes off. There's a kind of a street hustler guy who's like, hey, I'll challenge you to a couple rounds of basketball. And Axel kind of just totally, like, shows this guy up, realizes he was going to get hustled, and just kind of uses his moves on him. And so moves, I'm sure, are not legal in real basketball, but I guess this is street basketball. So maybe, yeah, street rules, because he's doing things like tripping them and stuff like that. So, yeah.
Generally speaking, I actually think this episode is the best looking episode so far, just in terms of animation and also just the environment, art, and even just like animation, not necessarily during the basketball scene, but even just like Leland and Chris entering the apartment, there's just some character motions, just literally like moving around in the apartment, checking things, that I thought was pretty nice.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. I'll say that overall, the character work in this animation wise in this show so far has been really, really great. And we have a scene coming up here in just a moment after the commercial break when we come back that actually has some really phenomenal animation.
Yeah.
We'll get to that in just a second. I did want to mention briefly, though, that this is the second, maybe the third episode in a row where we get the eye catches. So they're not cutting out the eye catches, which is unusual for Toonami.
Well, the thing is, they're saving time speeding up the ending, so now they have eye catch time.
I understand. Yeah, it's frustrating because the ending is so good. Why keep the eye catches in and then cut the ending? I don't know. Anyway,
so one thing I want to say just before we move on to the kind of the after the eye catch and whatnot. Well, actually, two things I want to say. One of them is I thought this actually episode in general kind of did one of the better jobs of kind of humanizing the characters, you know, fleshing them out a little bit, getting to know more about them. I thought also kind of the setting of the homeless encampment and kind of what it meant, I think did a pretty good job of offering some kind of social commentary, just in the fact that, like, they met Jill, they're talking to her about how, like, people are a little, like, a lot of people here kind of are, like, more of the more marginalized people in the society and whatnot, and so people are a little hesitant just to kind of reveal themselves or reveal what's going on with them, so that's why she was a little hesitant to, like, try to, like, help them about trying to find the Douglas's old professor, but kind of, like, the commentary on transgender individuals, and, of course, Douglas mentioning that, and this is not something I even realize. It's actually still true now. And apparently in this universe, true still 27 years in the future, there are no Nobel laureates in the sciences who are black. And that was something that Douglas was actually trying to do. He was, as we mentioned, a scientific researcher. So that's kind of his dream and something And then he was him talking about his old professor, how that kind of dream was still felt unattainable. It was like, oh wow, I didn't realize that kind of like, you know, this is not like necessarily utopian future. It feels kind of like it is 27 years in the future, but like kind of a weirdly realistic 27 years in a weird sense. So I think just kind of delving in terms of like the people at this encampment, kind of like their backstories, kind of where they came from, what they represent in terms of like how they fit into society, and even tying that into like both Douglas's backstory and the from the professor and all that stuff. I thought that was kind of generally well executed for anime, for the context of what type of show it is. I thought it's kind of generally well executed social commentary. So I thought that was well done on a show in that part, that respect. And I appreciate, I guess, or give kudos to Watanabe for kind of going there and exploring those subjects in this show. So that was something.
To I would say too that the way they portrayed the homeless camp is actually really good. Like I agree with that too. It's like it's not obviously something that it's not a good thing, but none of the people that are there really are depicted as being bad or wrong or anything like that. They're just homeless, and they're doing the best they can, and they portrayed them in a very positive light in that regard. And I liked that. And it was a very good community that was portrayed, and the way that the transgendered character Jill was displayed, I thought was very off, just kind of there, like not really delved into too much. They really even commented on maybe once and it was over with. And it's just sort of like, that's a really, progressive, good way of doing that. You know, don't make a big deal out of it. It's just, that's just what happened. No big
like
deal.
Axel and Jill just pick up their friendship as if nothing ever happened. And I think that's
right.
That's the way to go about it. Like, obviously they recognize what had changed, but they're like, yeah, we're friends. We're still friends. Why would that change at all? And just kind of picked up, like old time sake in a set. So.
Yeah, there was only one line that was like very maybe slightly clunky, but I don't really mind it, where she says, I'm a transgender woman with a record, blah, 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 which is kind of just, I found that just a little bit clunky, just kind of like kind of announcing it. But also just I think it also just in the context of the show where this character we may not ever see again, just kind of, you know, just to kind of like state it clearly to the person watching the show. Yes, she is transgender. And not like just a cross-dresser or something like that, you know, like making it clear and obvious this is a transgender person who has changed their gender identity. So it's a little bit clunky, but I don't mind it.
I think more than anything, I like the fact that the show went there to show these underclass or underprivileged people and did it in a very positive light and to show that, you know, there's just all walks of life. And yeah, and I definitely liked the relationship between Jill and Axel and how they just sort of, like you said, just picked right up where they used to be friends, and they're still friends and nothing's changed, and it's great.
Yeah, no shock or surprise at all. It's just kind of like, oh, okay.
Yeah, I kind of like both agree it was a little clunky, but then I remember in the year of our Lord 2025 and what American politics looks like, and I was like, you kind of got me, show. Like, if you know, so I don't want to delve too far into that, but like, it's both kind of clunky, but also I'm looking out in the mirror and like looking out the window in real life, and it's like, maybe it's not that clunky? Question mark.
Yeah, it was fine. It was fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's move on. So after the break, we come back and everyone's returned to the headquarters, and they're trying to, or maybe they didn't return to the headquarters immediately, but they're Alana is searching for information about this Belinda, Skinner's grandmother, which apparently there is no information online about her at all. And she suspects that it looks like it's possible information about her may have been erased.
First of all, I'm actually kind of surprised. I sort of assumed when they first mentioned her grandma, like, oh, she's got to be dead now. Because Skinner is in his 50s, right? Like, and his grandma, whether or not it's like a related grandma or not, like, she's got to be pretty old. Like, is there's a chance she's no longer alive? But that didn't turn out to be the case. But like, they just sort of assume that she's alive and well. And
that's a little unusual. I thought the same thing.
I mean, to be slightly fair, we're hoping in 25 years medical technology is improved, so you get more people in their 90s or whatnot still being like you know, obviously elderly as hell, but still capable and able. So, like, I wouldn't be surprised.
Or maybe they could find information on her, even if she was deceased. That might lead to something. But yeah, this, it was just like nobody even mentioned that she might be dead.
I don't know. Like, if she's in her 80s or 90s, if she had if his grandmother had her children when she was young, and she's in her 80s or 90s now or something, that's still all seemed viable enough to me. It wasn't like Skinner was in his 90s himself or something. Like, there was like, okay, grandma has to be stretching past the centennial, where that's becomes a bit of a stretch. But I don't know. That didn't. What bugged me about the grandma potentially, or I say bug in quotation marks, it's just more like a weird plot contrivance. Even though her information may have been erased by Skinner, I do find it hard to believe that the police or Interpol or FBI or whoever the fuck didn't remember that or didn't realize Skinner had an old friend, professor friend, that they could have talked to first. Like, the lead that Douglas and Axel got to, like, feels like the police should have gotten there first or something, or someone. I don't know.
Yeah, like, that's anyone who, if this, whatever university this was that Skinner worked at, you'd think they'd basically be questioning everyone there.
Yeah, exactly.
I agree with that. I also feel like, again, we're probably only like a week into this.
I think
this.
It's like 4 days.
Yeah.
I think at the end of the episode, it's in 26 days.
I think that maybe, you know, I don't know, like Lazarus is just, they're just moving really fast. Yeah.
So Leland and Axel head to Istanbul. They find like a section of the city that is sort of like a dark zone where there is no information. And like, it's got to be probably here. So that's where they go.
Yeah. They take a thing called the hypercube. Did I read that right? It's just basically like a transatlantic.
It's a hyper something. I don't remember the exact name. I was just amused that apparently we were able to finally develop high speed rail in America. It just took us 27 more years or something. But
yeah. Well, I think it's intercontinental from at least
well,
in the show.
In America right now, right? They're in America right now, right? So then they go over.
Yeah, Istanbul, but they're going to Istanbul. So I think it's going across the ocean.
But it still had to be built in America at all to even get across there. So that's still very impressive. It's a few more decades and we'll get there.
When they get there, Leland puts on a sort of garb to kind of try to blend in, which is Axel gives him flack for, and I think rightfully so, because he's really the only person dressed like that.
Yeah, because that garb looks more like what you'd see in Saudi Arabia, but they're going to Turkey. So, like, I don't think people in Turkey would dress like that, so...
I think the joke there is that Leland doesn't really understand that. But anyway, he does stick out like a sore thumb, and Axel warns him about that, to which point they immediately run into a local street gang, a bunch of thugs who try to rob them. And this leads to a little, it's just a real brief sort of like escape sequence / combat sequence where Axel is sort of defending Leland from these attackers. And this is the moment I was talking about earlier where, again, at least once per episode, we get a scene like this where it's just the animators flaunting it, just really showing off, and it looks really good.
Axel just put up in like it does best.
Yeah, and this is, again, when I was watching this, I kind of got the impression, okay, this is another sort of Axel thing, that like another reason why they might have wanted him on the team. It's not just that he's a great parkour artist or a great escape artist, but he actually kind of in this scene has a lot of combat skills. He's able to disarm people with guns and, you know, and put them down. So he has combat skills as well, at least to a certain degree.
But Leland tries to keep up, but he can't really. He actually falls through a roof.
Oh, okay. I didn't write this down with the little girl, the scene with the little girl.
Yeah. This little girl is, I forget what she's doing. She's playing like with dolls or something. And she says something like, "We're waiting for the prince," and then he falls and like, "There's the prince." It's kind of, you know, kind of just jokey, but immediately after that, Leland kind of gets caught. It seems like these thugs are basically looking for valuables, and they see that he's wearing that little wrist thing, and they don't know what it is, but they assume that it's a valuable wrist thing, and they can't get it off of him, so they get an axe and they're about to chop his arm off. Like, well, they're going to get that thing off his arm one way or the other.
Yeah. And then I think he's just crying out, we're just looking for someone named Belinda. And then everyone stops and are like, Belinda? Oh, we know Belinda, Granny Belinda.
Oh, yeah. They mentioned
it's a little bit silly, too. But they're like, baklava, baklava, baklava. We all love baklava. And that's, I guess, good enough for them.
Yeah. They're like, well, we'll take you to there. And so they take her to the Belinda and we meet her and Axel and Leland are there and they're kind of talking to her and Belinda's talking about her relationship with Skinner. And I'm kind of just paraphrasing here, but she's basically like, oh, he was a sweet guy, a sweet kid. And
she's not his real grandma.
Right. I think that's the confusion we had earlier in our conversation. Right. I don't think she's literal biological. Yeah.
Yeah. She's just an older woman in this community that took him in.
Right.
That's the way I read it. So
no, she is his I'm pretty sure she is his biological grandmother. It's just didn't his parents die and then she raised him.
Well, she mentioned his parents died, but I don't think did it ever confirm that his parents were her children.
I don't think so. I don't think so. I think that's where the confusion is coming in about her age and everything. As I think she helped raise him, but maybe not as a blood relative.
I could have sworn they're like biologically related, but I'm not sure. I'll have to check again. But anyway.
Yeah, check on that because I think it doesn't make sense. Like we said earlier, her age doesn't really fit either. So maybe she's just like a community leader who took him in kind of thing. She does show them, though, a message. She's like, when was the last time you talked to him? It's, it was like 3 months ago. Or what was it? She's like, 3 years ago.
3 years.
3 years ago.
Before disappeared.
3 years ago. And she, right, basically. And she shows them a video message that he had sent her. And it's a very benign message. She's just like, hey, Belinda, I really miss you. I wish I could come see you. I just don't have any time right now. I hope you're well. You know, have a great day. And it's something to that effect. But this was interesting that he sent this message because it perfectly coincides with the time right around the time that he disappeared. And that's all they have to go on. And then the final scene of basically when they're wandering around the house, Axel has a suspicion. He's like, you know, this Skinner guy, he's too connected. He's too smart. He wouldn't, you know, he knows that it's possible someone could find Belinda. So he would certainly do something to kind of protect her. And he looks around and sure enough, he finds a little small hidden camera among her planters and is like, just immediately assumes it must be Skinner on the other end.
And then on the other end is probably, very likely, one of the other two hackers that was mentioned earlier.
Right. We do see the bottom of their face. Yeah.
We see the bottom of the face and some hands. We don't really get a good look at them. But then Alana, who earlier in the episode mentioned setting a trap, basically is like, gotcha. Caught this person in a trap because they must have
909.
You're about to get wrecked.
Did they say which one it was?
Like, yeah, she said it was Dr. 909. She's like, I gotcha.
I forgot that she mentioned which one it was, but yeah, she caught them and that was where the episode ended.
With some gamer lead.
She said something really.
He's going to get wrecked or pawn sword or something.
Like, oh, yeah. I think that was it. It was like, get wrecked or something like that. And then there we go. And then we got like, you know, our normal outro. So, I understand that people are a little conflicted with this show as far as like some of the dialogue in it. I, again, didn't really notice it too much. And overall, I found this episode very enjoyable. Again, it's not blowing me away, but I'm like, I'm glad I'm watching this. This is intriguing. I do want to find out more. What is the mystery of what is Skinner up to? Why is he so nice? And then this thing happens. Was it deliberate? There's enough mystery there to keep me wanting to know more. Crocodile, what are your thoughts?
I do think this is the best episode so far. So I definitely agree with your interpretation. That's not necessarily blowing me away, but I am definitely enjoying it. I do think considering it's part of the pharmaceutical power hour of common side effects, it kind of like looks a little worse for wear compared to common side effects. So that comparison is probably not to Lazarus and a fitting when it comes to dialogue and stuff like nature. I think it's working well so far. It could be stronger, but it's doing its job well enough right now. I'm enjoying it.
And Seda?
I agree that this is the strongest episode so far. I wish I cared a little bit more about I wish, like I said for the last episode, I wish there was a little bit more intrigue in like the forward thrust here. It's literally just, we got to find this guy and make him talk. is just a little bit too boring for me. Like, I don't know. But I do think I like the presentation is great. Just the show itself. And I feel like the characters are slowly starting to grow on me. Not really. I'm not there yet. But kind of like what you said earlier, Seacolder, like I'm enjoying this well enough, but it's not blowing me away. We'll see where it goes from here. I know a lot of people have like the 3-episode rule when it comes to shows or anime in particular, and I kind of wouldn't blame people if after this episode they're just like, "I'm not feeling it," and they would drop it at this point, because I think this show is sort of missing kind of that hook from the get go to really kind of get its claws into you. So we're showing patience by continuing here, but yeah, it's just I'm enjoying it well enough, but it's not blowing me away.
It's not blowing you away. I agree. I mean, I'm enjoying it. Again, this was my fear. I'm not ready to call it yet. We're way too early. But like my fear before the show aired was like, it'll just be sort of okay. And that's kind of what it's been. I think I'd say it's a little better than just okay, but not much. It's still just sort of middle of the road. And you did mention too, I wanted to say that there is a little bit more, I'm getting a little bit more comfortable with these characters. I really want the show to do more with them and kind of really have them have some pathos in their lives. Cause right now they're just sort of doing the job and they're kind of fun when they like work off each other, particularly like in this episode with Axel and Douglas, just their mannerisms conflicting and stuff. But I want there to be more. I want there to be stakes in their lives. And right now they're just sort of like just doing the job. So if they add some more stakes, I think that would help.
I suspect that will come in due time. I'm willing to give it time to get there.
Absolutely. Well, let's move on to common side effects. Common Side Effects, Episode 8, Amelia and Wyatt. And when I first saw the title of this, I'm like, well, who and who? But just to make it clear, Amelia is the name of Amelia Mushroom, the mycologist from the previous episodes. And we learned, and I think it was already said before, that her son is named Wyatt.
Yeah, they've name dropped them both a bunch of times, especially Amelia. So, but
yeah, I just couldn't remember it all. But this episode made it very clear to me. So like I predicted, Marshall wakes up in the morgue. He is in a, they do a little bit of a fake out in this opening sequence where it kind of feels like he's trapped in there or something. And then they, it's like, I can't remember how it went, but like they opened it and he wasn't in there, but then we like cut to another shot and it's actually, he was in a different one with Amelia opening it.
No, kind what of pulling happened him out is and that, helping him. Amelia came to pick up the quote unquote corpse earlier in the episode. And then what do you call it? Then Capano and Harrington came with the coroner. And then he's like, oh yeah, I forgot. Like someone picked it up already. So he shouldn't even be here because he had forgotten. And then they went to watch the video and then they realized, oh shit, Amelia Mushrooms was the one who picked.
That does happen later. But I think you're forgetting a shot that happened at the very beginning of the episode where they're kind of making it. I'm not doing it justice, but if you went back and watched the opening again, you'd understand that like there was a moment there, a beat where they're kind of like making it seem like something happens in that shot where it's like misleading.
I thought it was he regained his consciousness in the body bag, but obviously the problem is if you start breathing in this body bag and you're stuck there, you're eventually going to just suffocate and actually die. So he's kind of like freaking out, like he's in this bag. What is he going to do? He's awake and conscious. But then just kind of like in the nick of time, Amelia comes and gets him out.
Yeah, my reading of this maybe that's opening was the same as Sita's. That's my recollection of what happened generally.
Okay.
Yeah, he regained his consciousness. And, you know, had Amelia been late an hour or whatever, it's possible that Marshall could have suffocated himself and actually died, but she was.
There was a shot of an employee leaving or something, like insinuating he was going to get trapped or something.
There was a janitor around there or something, like I think I remember that part.
Yeah. Anyway, it's not important. I think I'm making a big deal out of it, but I just remember when I was watching it thinking, oh, they did a little trick on me there, a little switcheroo to kind of make it seem like the situation was way more dire when in fact, Amelia was there all along ready to help him out. So
anyways, to answer a question from last week, I think last week we posed the kind of question, like, how is he gonna, if he's gonna take this poison or drug or whatever to kind of like quote kill himself, how is he going to resuscitate himself? And I guess the answer is, it's just whatever this component, this thing that he took was, it literally like stopped his heart temporarily, but eventually wears off on its own. I suppose he took just the right amount that it didn't, you know, kill him really, but it made him appear dead momentarily for, you know, maybe a half a day or whatever it was.
Yeah.
That's all it was he just took enough to basically, yeah.
Yeah. Both Marshall and Amelia are familiar enough with the toxin to, like, that was our plan. They knew what they were doing. Like, so yeah.
Yeah. Well, I didn't know if he was going to like take a mushroom later or someone somehow feed a mushroom, if a mushroom was going to factor into this at all, but no, it didn't.
Yeah, I was wondering that too. And yeah, they didn't, I guess that wasn't an issue at all. It was just that medicine wears off, or that drug wears off.
A concoction or whatever it was. Yeah.
Yeah. So we cut to a scene at the horse races, and our two DEA agents are there on vacation, but Capano is, I think that's the black guy, right?
Yeah, Capano. Yes. Yep.
Yeah. He is just, I mean, as is his way, he is just got the conspiratorial mind going, not even conspiratorial, but like just the problem solving, trying the detective mindset going on. And he's like, I want to tell you something really interesting. And if you do, you're going to have to, you know, it's going to blow your mind.
He's pretty much absolutely correct on all in his conjectures here.
Yeah.
Doing, it's also just amusing that he's doing this with like a mayonnaise packet. And
yeah, he does have conspiratorial like leanings, but not to the point of like it's actually problematic. And also he's in a conspiracy, so it just happens to work out perfectly. But he just kind of has that kind of mentality, but obviously he's still a very competent detective and whatnot. So
yeah. So he kind of puts it together. He kind of puts it all together, just like Seda said. He gets it exactly right. And he also makes it perfectly clear. He's like, this is why we were kicked off the case. And it is exactly why we should not leave it. We need to make sure, we need to be involved. We need to solve this. We need to put this together. And so he convinces her to kind of help him out.
And their plan is to go to Marshall in prison.
Right. Back at the Resudicol Research Lab, there's a scene with Kiki, Francis, and Rick all together where they're doing experiments on rabbits with the mushroom. And Kiki says that the bunnies are responding very well to the mushroom. However, for them to continue the research, they need more of them.
Yeah, they're having trouble growing them.
Yeah.
Yeah, more of the mushroom, to be clear, not the bunnies. So just...
Yeah. And there's just a kind of like little scene there where, you know, again, there's more of this sort of Francis sort of grappling with the ethics of things, particularly in this case, the ethics of testing it on animals. And Rick is like very flippant about it. And he's like, it's fine. They wouldn't even exist if, you know, they wouldn't even be alive if it weren't for us. And, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Well, it's
they're getting better. They're getting better health than most people do. You know,
yeah,
stuff
it's
like
one
that.
Of those things where, like, again, the characters or like in this case, Rick, what he's saying is absolutely 100% correct. But it's still a little bit kind of disassociated from like what's going on here. It's like nothing he's saying is wrong, but he's kind of still a dick about it in a way, the kind of thing. It's a little hard to describe, but yeah.
No, I get it. Yeah, he's totally right. I mean, like he's very flippant about the situation, but he's 100% accurate. Like, I love the line about it. He's like, these rabbits are probably getting better health care than most people are, which is funny, but and sad. Francis then goes back to the office and gets a call from, or her assistant says that she's getting a call from jail and she's really worried. Oh no, Marshall's calling him. Marshall's calling her. And she's like, Marshall, is that you? And then, no, it turns out to be that guy who is her cellmate. Yeah.
What was his name? Like, Juan or something?
Hey, I just wanted to. I don't remember.
I think his name is Juan, but apparently this guy is considerate enough I guess, knew that Francis was a person that was important to Marshall. And it's like, he's considerate enough to call her and be like, yeah, Marshall was taken away. He doesn't say, I think, verbatim that he's dead. Right. I don't think, but he basically just says like, yeah, he left and didn't come back.
Well, he mentions,
well, he said
he was sick. Like, you got really sick. It took him away and he never came back.
He also said too, that he said that Marshall asked him to call her. He said, he said, if something happens to me, I want you to call this woman and let her know that something happened. So he did. Marshall at least had the foresight to have Juan do this. I do agree that it's Juan is maybe going a little out of his way to call Francis on this. It doesn't seem very in character for him. I kind of took that as just like, what the hell else is he going to do? He's in prison. So why not call her?
Juan and Marshall had a little kind of some butting of heads, but Marshall still did like save Juan's life or something. So I think there's just kind of a sense of gratitude there. Yeah. Like, so.
Yeah, that's true. And then she kind of puts it together. It's like, oh no, he's dead. So then we get this scene where Rick is meeting with Jonas the Wolf. And this is probably my favorite scene.
Well, I do think we should mention before this that the news of Marshall's death does reach Cecily and Jonas as well. And they start doing their, you know, their machinations to clean everything up. And then once that is news is made aware, I think that's when Jonas eventually meets up with Rick later.
Yeah. So, yeah, real briefly, the DEA agents try to contact they go back to their DEA office or whatever, and they ask the information person there, like, look up information on this guy. And she's like, you can't do that. And it's like, oh, da, 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 and they do it. Like, come on, just do it. And she does. And he's like, well, he's gone. He's like, what do you mean gone? Like, he's dead. All right. Then we get back, like I said, we're in a scene with where Rick is with Jonas, and Rick is trying to convince Jonas. He's like, I've got this new medicine. It's going to change everything. If we do this, it's going to change the world. It's going to heal people. Rick is really on the good guy side here. And then Jonas says, you know, he's kind of doing what he's always been doing. He's like, you know, we can't do this. This is not going to work. And he starts out by kind of doing the thing you expect him to do. He's like, you know, if you do this, you're going to get fired. The healthcare industry will collapse. Millions of people will lose their jobs, kind of like the corporate side of it. But then he keeps going.
Yeah, the first things he mentioned, like, well, this medicine is going to replace all of our other medicines, which isn't good for business. And then people are going to stay healthy, which isn't good for business. And people aren't going to get sick. And so on and so forth about collapsing this industry if we have this kind of miracle mushroom.
Yeah. But then he goes on, and that's when it gets really interesting. He paints this picture. He's like, now imagine a world where there is this miracle cure that can cure anything. And if people can be brought back from serious injury, people are going to shoot and maim each other willy-nilly because now they know it can be cured so easily. And he kind of paints this picture of this dark dystopian future where cartels and other things are like hoarding the medicine and gang wars are on the rise. And it's like, in that moment, I'm like, I kind of believe him. Like that seems like that's a very plausible outcome.
Like something I think this, obviously Jonas is just a gigantic piece of shit and kind of the jokes he's about, I drink, I get a hangover, there's balance. Oh, Americans work for the healthcare. That's so good. I love it. Like all these, he's a huge piece of shit, right? He's basically the main villain of this story. But I think, again, in this terms of like characters are kind of douchebags, but saying things that are kind of accurate. Like Jonas's point about there being a significant amount of negative externalities from something like this isn't really wrong. Like, I've obviously known this forever and so has everyone else, but kind of this point really was stressing me recently. I lost my aunt a few years ago. It was pretty sudden and tragic. I don't want to go too much detail, but it was pretty sudden. Our family's pretty shook up about it. But like during that whole episode, something that kind of really pressed me was about how much of kind of like, for better or worse, how much of human society is kind of structured based on the fact that not only we die, but like, we only live about like 70, 80, 90 years, like that kind of general human lifespan, just about how businesses work, how religion works, how communities work, like everything about how humanity has structured itself is based around here's our finite lifespan and it's about this long, give or take. Obviously some people get lucky, unlucky, but it's about this length. And now if you take that lifespan and you just say like, double it or something as that much. Like the mushroom doesn't like stop aging, but like if you like get rid of like traumas or like cancers or whatnot, it has a pretty big change on like human civilization. It's like, okay, people live longer, get to stay with families longer, they get to be more productive. That's really, it's better to the sciences, the arts, lots of good things come out of it. Obviously, your family stay together longer, people live longer, that's good. But then there are lots of externalities that kind of like, what does that mean for organized human religion? What does that mean for other sorts of businesses? What does it mean for like diplomacy, war, peace? Like, he's not wrong in that if you just like doubled everyone's lifespan, which would be maybe like the moderate estimation of what the mushroom could do, that's lots of like things you don't expect to happen could happen that are not great. Like, you should still, if you could do this, you should still do this. I think benefits are way more worth it, but he's not wrong in that that would have significant and potentially negative impacts on how human civilization and society would play out. That's actually, he's not actually wrong about that. He's just a piece of shit. But like that narrow point that like, this seems really good, but negative consequences could flow from it is not wrong. And of course, even right. Shiro goes into itself about, it's called common side effects. We're still not entirely sure what the side effects of the mushroom are. We'll go into that a little bit more in future episodes, and I'm sure season two will delve into that more. But like, this mushroom still has a side that's not really explored. Obviously, Jones doesn't know about that, but like, you know, it's not all positives. There like are negative things considered.
Yeah, I think, again, I mostly wanted to just point out the aspect you talked about how like organized crime and stuff would, how that would be affected by this sort of miracle cure and how it could change things. And that's the big part where I was like, yeah, he's probably onto something there. Like any kind of controlled substance or something could really turn out to be bad. It's kind of like the much, much, much darker vision of what we saw in Lazarus with the way Hapna was received, you know, sort of a miracle cure. And that was a very sort of positive way that it was seen, even if it did have some people using it for recreational purposes. He kind of, in this moment, Jonas sort of pictures like a worst case scenario, like if there was a miracle cure, how would that, you know, how would that affect society in a negative way? But obviously, he's really trying to paint a dark picture here to scare
Rick. No, I think Rick. About his narrow point about organized crime is wrong. But even beyond that, I think it's like also true that if such a thing were to exist, like you obviously want it to exist, you want to do it. I think the positives probably outweigh the negatives, but they are potential negatives and kind of broadly in terms of how human society would kind of fundamentally change. Like, things can get wacky.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I agree. Let's continue. So Frances goes home.
Well, she's staying up late in her office.
Oh, right.
Because she just learned that Marshall died. And, you know, what is she going to do? She doesn't know how to process this. She's actually watching Marshall on old YouTube videos. Like, she can't believe she's gone kind of thing. And he actually misses a date with her fiance, Nick. She shows up and basically realizes that Nick is going to propose, and she's just like, I mean, obviously she just learned her friend died, and she never was seem to be too much into Nick anyways, and kind of like, I can't do this right now, and dumps him.
Yeah, just sort of like, it's over, I can't deal with this, and just walks away. Be interesting if we see any more of him. I kind of feel like we might not, I don't know, but
the thing is Nick he's never been portrayed as necessarily like a bad person. Like in the first episode, he's kind of like inobservant, kind of, but like, I don't know. It's not really his fault. He tried to set up a date.
He was also there for her at her mother's funeral. So I think the best read of Nick is that he's kind of stupid, but he's not bad.
Yeah, I get. Yeah. I was going to say he's just very aloof and kind of not really, like, just doesn't understand, like, he has a very simple mind, and he doesn't really understand or even recognize the cues that Frances is giving him about their relationship. He's just sort of like, oh, we're a couple, and it's great, and we should get married, and she's, like, obviously not into him that much, so.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so Frances goes back home to her apartment, and bam, Marshall is there. He's looking for Socrates, and they have a little bit of a moment here. She's of course amazed that he's alive, but Marshall's pissed, and maybe rightfully so. But he's very much like, oh, you really care? Oh, okay. I guess. And she's like, I thought you were dead. It's like, as far as you're concerned, I am dead. And he's just really angry with her and storms off and gets a cab or something.
There was a, I know that during this pretty serious scene, he throws the water bottle, but he can't really throw it. And he's like, I'm usually more athletic than that, but my arms are, I forget what he said, but like my arms.
Well, he says something about that drug having affected him.
Yeah, they're still recovering. It's like, yeah, you're definitely usually more athletic than that.
His muscles are so dull.
Marshall and athletic are not, that's not how I would describe him.
No, I mean, Marshall is like weirdly athletic for given his size. Like he, dude runs after planes and like shit, like he's like, yeah, he's weirdly in shape considering how long.
Yeah, I guess he is. He is. I think he was just a little embarrassed in that moment because he couldn't toss that. But he mentions that it was that drug that he took is still affecting.
Oh, yeah, that was funny. But like,
and that's a little bit of that. Yeah, it's that little bit of humor. Like this show is not that funny, really, but there are moments where you can see the comedy. There are little comedic moments like that in there that I
also
like.
Meant like it was also kind
oh,
of
oh, and I do remember now.
It was a little point where Amelia and her son was there as well, and like and Wyatt is like drawing shit on the wall, which will become relevant in a moment. But like Francis starts tries to talk to them, and then Amelia's like, "Don't talk to my son." And I just remember that meme, like, "Don't talk to me and my son ever again." You know that meme that just popped in my head when that happened.
Yeah, and that I do remember now. That's why that's how they leave is that. Amelia is driving Marshall around.
And,
so
this is a little bit off the topic here, but we were talking about side effects earlier. There was a couple of moments in this scene, especially one in the car, where Marshall looks like he sees that little white drug dude. I don't know what you call that guy.
A gremlin or something.
In,
I don't
like,
know what it
Wyatt's
is.
Wyatt's hand.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then like he sees that guy, that thing in Wyatt's hand. And then he like blinks and looks again and it's gone. And he's just kind of like, huh? Like he literally says, huh? And it's like, that's definitely building to something where I think there was a couple other points in this episode also where they're starting to see this.
Yeah.
That actually happens a little bit later after the scene where they visit Zane. But we'll get to that. We'll get, but okay. That I do remember that happening because there's actually something that leads into that, but we'll talk about.
Yeah, I think why it's seeing it at Zane's place is happens then Marshall sees it then. I think that's the order.
Right. Yeah. I'll get to that. Oh, okay. You're skipping over. But the big thing that happens in this scene is right before they leave. Well, right after they leave, Frances notices that, you know, like Wyatt has been drawing on her walls, but she notices a little depiction that he put on her walls, which is a depiction of Socrates pooping on the ground with mushrooms coming out.
Very well drawn on it.
Yeah. So very big clue here. That Wyatt, I don't know if I'm assuming not deliberately has given her, but just now she has access to that information that Socrates is the key.
I also think on Marshall mentioning you don't even realize how much more important Socrates is than you as he leaves. I think that also probably keyed her in, like all those clues together. I think keyed her in.
There's a very 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 brief short scene of Rick just standing on the golf field, kind of peering off in the distance, just very contemplative. A sprinkler goes off, just starts hitting him in the face with water, and he doesn't even move. He's just so in deep thought.
Well, also
about his situation
he also three balls of vodka. So I mean that too.
Yeah.
But basically, that's a reaction from Jonas shutting him down, basically.
So Frances goes back to the office and sees her assistant packing her things up. Turns out assistant's been let go. He said, well, what about Rick? And Rick quit. And then, and Frances is like, well, what's going to happen to me? She's having, you know, and it's kind of like the writing's on the wall. It's like, hands her a box. And it's like, well, here you go. It's over. Then we go to this scene where, you know, Socrates has not been cared for very well, so Marshall takes him back to Zane's animal shop, and we get more of Zane and his non-pants wearing crazy zaniness, walking around acting weird. And he starts to take, you know, this is nothing really happens in this scene outside of the fact that they're just sort of like helping Socrates or whatever. But the real weird moment in this is that we were alluding to earlier is that. While they're talking, Wyatt is over there looking at the fishes in the fish tank. And for some reason, Wyatt sees one of those little gray dudes swimming around in the water there and little blips and stuff coming out of him like you see in those visions. I don't know if this is insinuating that Wyatt has taken a little bit of the mushroom or
no,
what.
No, we know that.
But he saw that little gray guy.
Amelia gave him the mushroom to cure him.
Oh, that's right. He took it to get healed. That's right.
I know he
took it. Yeah. Okay. So he's got the side effect. He's got the common side effect of seeing the little man. So he sees that in there. And which leads into the scene you talked about, Seda, where they then lead Zane. Yeah. I think Rick says something, in fact, he's like, see you later, Zane. You may never see me ever again.
You mean Marshall.
Something to that effect. You
mean Marshall says that.
Yeah, you said Rick, but you mean Marshall.
Oh, yeah, Marshall. Thank you.
Yeah.
He's like, you may never see me ever again. Very serious. But that's when they're in the car and Rick turns around. Now he's got the side effects. He's starting to see the weird little creature in Wyatt's hand.
Yeah. Now, earlier when we so first of all, Wyatt seems like kind of like nonverbal, like not like not neurotypical, probably, maybe. And so, like, how do I put this? When he draws Socrates in the crayon on the wall, like, how would he know that, like, a turtle pooping on mushrooms, like, why would he even draw that? Like, and from his perspective, he just took a mushroom and got better. Like, I'm wondering if this is something that he sort of, like, because he's taken the mushroom, he kind of just, like, somehow knows
what
now.
What I want to say is that there's something I want to bring up, and, not now, at the series review, something I want to bring up that's kind of related to this, and also related to the video of Francis watching Marshall. That's also a bit of a clue, I think, and I want to discuss that when we review the series overall in a few weeks. But just put a pin on that is all I say.
I just assumed that he had overheard them talking about it. That's my theory. Mm-hmm. I thought that Wyatt had just been listening in on their conversations, and that at some point Marshall had told Amelia this.
It just seems like a very specific thing for him to draw. Like,
yeah. Why draw it?
Mushroom. Yeah. Like, yeah, like, why would he draw it? Like, it's just something that he's thinking about because he's taken the mushroom, or I'm not sure. And
yeah,
like,
that is,
maybe
that's strange.
I'm not sure exactly what he's seen. Like, he's on his like little phone device thing all the time, whatever it is. Is his pad? Like, what's he watching? I don't know.
A Game Boy.
He's playing some game or something. Yeah.
But, well, I guess
it looks like a little tablet game or a phone game. Yeah. And then we see a shot of Frances walking down the street with her box of things. It's, I think, raining, and she's just like, she's at her lowest now. She's lost. She for a moment there, she was vice president and everything was great, and now she's lost everything. Up pulls Rick in his car, and she's kind of like, Rick? And then he rolls, you know, he kind of looks at her, holds up the mushroom and says, want to go into business? That's an interesting twist I didn't see coming. And then the final scene is Amelia,
actually,
Wyatt, and Marshall are returning.
There's one more scene before then that I think is really important. And when Jonas goes to the doctor.
Okay.
Do you remember that?
Oh, right.
And he gets a cancer diagnosis.
Yeah, he gets diagnosed with potential cancer or something. Yeah,
that is very significant. There's not too much more to say about that now, besides that it's super ironic given all the spiel he was giving earlier. Then now he needs a mushroom, basically. But that is going to be an important plot point in future episodes, so just put a pin on that. But yeah, don't skip that scene, or don't forget that. Yeah,
it looked like one of his. It showed like the nurse or the doctor was looking at like an X-ray of his lungs, and it looked like one of his lungs was like.
Yeah, it looked,
I don't want to say collapsed necessarily, but like one of his lungs looked okay.
It looked like
the other
a pretty
lung
large
like
mass. I think
not.
He has. I don't know if they ever say explicitly which cancer he has, but it looks like lung cancer and like pretty aggressive, or severe, or whatever.
Yeah. So, like I said, Amelia, Wyatt, and Marshall, Marshall's leading them to his little compound where he was trying to grow their mushroom earlier. They run into that one hillbilly kid there, and there's a bunch of new people here, and they're all working, and as they're walking up to the house, they see a little patch of the mushrooms being grown. People giving them a lot of side eyes, and they walk in. And who else is sitting there? Turns around. It's Hildy with a smirk on her face. Apparently she's figured it out or something.
But I don't think, was she growing the mushroom? Yeah. I don't know if they figured it out yet. I can't remember if it's now or the next episode of the Hildy.
Well, there were a bunch of little mushrooms growing there. I don't know if those were the ones from before or if they're new ones. I don't know.
I don't think Hildy knows yet. I think she finds out next episode when Marshall...
No, I don't think she knows how to do it. I don't think she does either. Right. I thought that she had grown them, but as I'm talking here, I'm thinking maybe they just found the.
Okay, I think that's my that's the more my recollection. Yeah. Okay.
And there you go. That's that episode.
Two more left.
Oh, really? Only two, huh?
I mean, okay. It shows dense.
Well, they've already confirmed a second season.
It packs a lot of content. Yeah. The next two episodes are...
A lot can happen in two episodes.
Yeah, the next two episodes are pretty content rich. So, like, don't despair. There's a lot of stuff to enjoy in the next two episodes.
And that's the par for the course for this show.
Right, every episode but it's
hugely content rich.
It's very dense.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'm glad to hear that. But, I mean, at the same time, I'm not surprised. This show is very, 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 very... Yeah, a lot of depth goes on in every episode. It's good stuff, though. I mean, unless you guys have anything more to add, another great episode is all I have to say. All right, well, let's move on to One Piece. One Piece, episode 719, a decisive battle in midair. Zoro's new secret technique blasts. So, okay, see you later, Crocodile. He's heading out. We're watching as Titan Pika is walking towards the plateau to crush Riku. I'm going to breeze through this because it's One Piece. Stop me if you need me to, Seta.
Go ahead.
The people, Riku's telling all the citizens, leave, get here, he only wants me. But the people love Riku and they stay to protect him, even though they really can't protect him. But they're willing to sacrifice themselves for Riku in this moment. Zoro has a plan. He wants Orlumbus. He saw Orlumbus throw someone earlier and he's got, you know, he knows he's really strong. So he's like, throw me like you threw that other guy earlier. And so Orlumbus uses this move called Commodore Killer Bowling, where he throws Zoro. This is, I think there's like an X-Men team that do something like this, like Wolverine and somebody. Maybe it's the Hulk, I forget. But somebody, they do the same thing where they throw Wolverine. It's like that. And then I know Zoro fans love this stuff, but I actually don't care. So I didn't write it down, but he names off this move he does with the swords. And it's like this really complicated thing where he says, like,
I was actually looking this up.
Oh, please.
I'm going to post this in the chat, like what it's called, and you can try to pronounce it.
All right, here we go. Yeah. It was really bizarre.
And it's kind of hard to hear when the English voice actor says it. And I don't use the subtitles or the closed captions or whatever. And it has like usually like some sort of like sound effect on the voice, which also kind of makes it hard to hear. And, you know, it's obviously not English words, so it's hard to like grasp, but I'm going to post it in the thread now.
Okay.
That's the ability that he uses.
I'll try to say this, but before he even says the name, he says something like across the four seas and the nine mountains and the something another within these, there is a world, but then beyond that, there are multiple worlds.
Okay. Here's what the One Piece wiki says.
Oh, please.
Zoro narrates that nine mountains and eight seas make up a world in which nothing he cannot be cut while spinning the two swords in his hands. Like, okay.
Yeah. And then he goes, but I can do all of them. And he says, and then he uses this movie called Three Sword Style, Ogi Ichidai, Saizen Daisen Sekai, which is not what he said in English. I don't know what he said. Something, there's a translated version of that. That was the Japanese version. But anyway, it's something weird like that. And this is this move that he's going to do, which he basically does. He cuts Pika's Titan form in half. And this, of course, leads to pretty much everybody, and I mean literally everybody, just like gasping and being like, oh my God. You know, but the one clever thing about this that I liked is that Zoro then realizes that as he cuts the pieces apart, he can kind of tell where Pika's real body is within this mass, because part of it will be animated and the other part won't. So he just keeps slicing it into halves until he eventually gets down to like the arm that's falling, and he's like, oh, okay, it's in the arm. And he cuts it, keeps cutting it until ultimately he finds the real Pika body in there, who comes out. And then Pika's like, you think you can take me with my haki? And then Pika like hardens his entire body with hockey, kind of like that one guy did back in Punk Hazard.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get like some flashbacks, of course, because it's One Piece and it's pacing. We see the Mihawk battle from
again,
yeah, a million times. Yeah, we see, and we see some of the stuff where Mihawk was then later training him post time skip, and that stuff. And hey, we got to see Perona. There was Perona nearby. I like Perona. Yep. She's there. Perona's like this character who is like, she's not like a straw hat or anything, but like that. She's like one of those characters who's like an ally, but not like a real ally, but just like a partial ally.
Now there's hundreds of episodes I haven't seen of One Piece, but eventually she has to come back and do something, right? I don't know.
I don't know. I don't want to say.
She's just sort of sitting on Mihawk's little island there, I guess.
Yeah, there's a lot of characters in One Piece. I don't know. But I'd like to see more of her. But anyway, she's around. And she was there for the whole, like, him training with Mihawk. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So these two are going to face off, and this is the whole flashback with him training with Mihawk is him telling his Mihawk explains that like any sword can be a black sword if you can infuse it with haki. And so this is just him realizing, okay, this is how I can defeat Pika's haki is I need to do this. And so he uses 3000 worlds attack, which all his moves, I'm sorry, all his moves make no sense to me. Like, what does that even mean? What is 3000 worlds? What? Like,
I even remember earlier in this arc, he did 1080 caliber Phoenix, which I guess was like the biggest caliber Phoenix so far. Like, oh, wow.
But yeah, like, what does that mean? Cool. Like, I don't caliber? Know. Like, caliber, use calibers with guns, right? Like, what's a caliber, you know, sword?
It's just a number. The higher the number, the stronger it is.
But why caliber? Like, why doesn't he say like 1,000 pound or 1,000 ton strike or something? Like, what's a caliper? I don't get it. It's just,
well, next is going to be a 4K Phoenix.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah,
I don't know.
Or it'll be the 10,000 world attack. I don't know. Anyway, he defeats Pika. Pika's gone. Yep. Yay! No more Pika. No more annoying voice. And we finally learn what King Punch has been standing around doing this whole time. What's his ultimate thing? Is his payoff is that Zoro calls out to him. He's like, do it. And he just uses King Punch to basically blow away all the pieces so that they don't land on the people. So of which he's not particularly happy about. He's just like, you just used me to clean up duty. Yeah. Yeah. So. Yeah. Anyway, that's pretty much that episode. So yeah, the Zoro.
So are there any commanders left?
Treble,
who's basically up there with Doffy.
Right, Treble, and I mean Bellamy.
And Bellamy's still bouncing around, which is the next episode.
Yeah, we'll get to that. So let's see, episode 720. So long, Bellamy's farewell blow. Oh my God. I mean,
half of this episode was kind of just recapping the previous episode.
Yeah, it was mostly like, oh, Pika's been defeated and everyone's recovering from that. Yeah. But the second half of the episode is, I guess I could talk briefly about that. So the Admiral, I forget whose name, I don't remember, the blind one, who has the gravity. Fujitora, I think that's right. Yes. Yeah. He uses his ability to prevent the rocks from falling on the citizens, his gravity ability, enough for them to escape, which is very cool. There was also like, even in the previous episode, there was a bit of the Marines sort of trying to protect the citizens from the Pika attack and stuff. Like Marines actually doing what they're supposed to do, which is nice to see.
Mm-hmm.
We also see that the Tontadas have successfully destroyed the factory. It's blowing up and they've defeated it, but Treble sees this and kind of just laughs. And he's like, oh, they think they've accomplished a big thing here to destroying the factory, but we'll just build another one and we'll just enslave them again. It's no big deal. You know, that's what his perspective
is. Yeah. He even mentions like, as long as we have Moncherry who can just heal everyone, but of course he doesn't know
yeah.
that she's been rescued.
And to which we cut to exactly that, Leo and Mancheri showing up with the little beetle guy, and they're at the Kyros and crew, and you're saved. And Mancheri desperately wants to heal Kyros because he's so injured, but of course Kyros being super manly, he's like, no, save it for other people. I don't deserve it, blah, 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 all that stuff. And then I guess Leo kind of puts it together that Kyros was the Kyros from the statue and the toy soldier. So now he knows. Mm-hmm. And then everyone claps for Zoro, who climbs up the side and meets them there. And everyone's happy that Zoro saved the day. And that's like the first half of the episode. And then the second half of the episode, I can sum up in just like one sentence, which that Bellamy is bouncing around, punching Luffy, says he wants to be killed by Luffy because he's the only man he's ever respected. And Luffy punches him and knocks him out.
And this isn't too surprising, but it's basically in the same manner that Luffy punched him 2 years ago in whatever that place is called. I'm just slipping my mind.
Jaya? Whiskey Peak or whatever.
Or was it Jaya or Whiskey? I'm getting it mixed up.
Oh, maybe it was Jaya. It might have been Jaya. Yeah. Anyway, yes, it's the same, almost the same shot, right? Like the same frame. Yeah.
Right.
The thing I didn't like about this scene, and I understand what Oda's going for here, but before Luffy punches Bellamy, he shouts, Doflamingo! Like he's really mad at Doflamingo for, I guess, this happening. But I'm just thinking, Bellamy brought this on himself.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not Doflamingo's fault that Bellamy's being dumb in this situation and being, like, stubborn. But Luffy, they try to play it off like Luffy's hand is forced in this moment to defeat Bellamy, and it's somehow Doflamingo's fault. At least that's how I read it.
Yeah, but I think even Luffy points out in this episode that Doflamingo basically said, Bellamy, you're freed. Go do whatever you want. Yeah. And Bellamy could have just left, but no.
I think this is this whole thing is just Bellamy, like his, I guess he was rejected by Doflamingo. He was, he thought he was strong, but it got defeated. He keeps getting defeated. And now he just has no pride left. And so he just wants to attack Luffy. And he basically says in this episode, he said, if anyone's going to kill me, I want it to be you because you're the only person who I've ever respected. And so I guess Luffy thought, you know, has no choice but to then punch Bellamy. I'm sure he doesn't kill Bellamy. I don't think Bellamy dies in this moment. I can't imagine Luffy killing anyone, but it knocks him out. So thank God this is over. That's this episode. So
yeah, like kind of relief in a sense. Yeah. That's like, all right, now I'm assuming the next episode, we're finally going to get started on the big, I kind of say this with two minds. We're finally going to get to the big fight of Luffy versus Doflamingo. But I also, and I know you agree, like I don't, One Piece fights are okay. Yeah. They're fine. They're not the main reason I watch, but like it's got to be better than this.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we know at least one big thing that happens in the, there are two really that I can think of, but there's definitely the big thing that happens in the Doflamingo fight that I'm sure even you are aware of. And yeah, that's something at least. And yeah, the Doflamingo is like, that's, the stakes are so much higher when it's Luffy and Doflamingo. But I'm with you too, that like, and I've said this, I said this half a year ago when I'm like, I like One Piece when we're learning about the world building. I like when they arrived at Dressrosa. I thought it was interesting. It's like, oh, we're learning about these new characters and new powers and a new country. The fights is just, to me, it's like, I'm just waiting for them to end, you know, so that we can move on to the next island. So that's kind of where we're at now. We've been in the fights forever.
And I know I have a friend of mine, and I know this isn't a totally unique take, has once said, like, I wouldn't mind if the fights, they just kind of put up one of those little like splash screens that just said 20 minutes later. And then we just like skip the fight, see what happens next. Like, all right, well, Luffy wins.
That SpongeBob mean. It's like,
just like, yeah, and here's where the fight would be, but we're just going to skip past it because, you know, whatever.
Right.
So, but yeah, it's like, it's got to be better than, yeah, like you said, there's at least stakes here. Like, Doflamingo, we've seen everything that he's done in the past to this nation, to King Riku's kingdom, and, you know, everything that he's done. So there's going to be hopefully some catharsis maybe in seeing him finally get what's coming.
That's what my hope is, that there will be that. And I think too, that like the other, like Pika and, you know, all these other generals, particularly Diamante, it's like, I don't really care. Like, their battles didn't really do anything for me. I thought that Lao Ji's is fun because it's just, it was like a comedic battle and it was kind of funny, but like, it's not a great battle or anything. It's just sort of goofy. The whole, I keep wanting to call him Baby Five, but that guy, his like backstory was, you know, whatever, is silly, but like, at least we knew something. But like, not all that was just sort of like fluff. That's just sort of like time filler to me. The main battle is what's interesting. And if any of them are going to be interesting, it's this one. You really want to see Doflamingo get his face punched in, you know? All right. So that's it for One Piece. Do we want to talk anything about any potential flavor alerts?
Play flavor alert.
Potential award nominations.
One that was kind of coming to mind, but I maybe want to hold off one or two more episodes to see how it turns out, is I'm considering putting Rick as best character.
Ooh, I like that. Yeah.
Like, he's not like a good person, but like the way that they're using him in this show in common side effects is compelling.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. A villain can be a best character for sure.
Yeah.
And he's not a villain.
I think you agree. He's not like, obviously Jonas is the villain, but and Rick is sort of like, I don't know. He's kind of like this really interesting kind of like anti-villain or anti-hero. Yeah. He's not a great person. He's not necessarily like got his heart in the right place at all times, but he's not necessarily like, you know, malicious at all times. He's just kind of just very interesting what they're doing with him. And I'm curious to see where they go with it from here.
Agreed. So. I can't tell if it's, I don't know if he's like had his eyes opened or maybe he was always this way and just wasn't vocal about it. I'm not really sure. That's again, the point is that his character is complex and this show has complicated characters and that's what makes them so good. And he's a really good one. I like Rick. Like, that's the thing. Like, even though Rick is kind of from time to time being flippant and been like, you know, kind of portrayed as like, you know, that one percenter, at the same time, he does come across very human and very, you know, it seems like his moral core is like in the right place. So, yeah, I like him. I like that guy.
But I don't know if we want to put him on now or see where they go from here.
Let's wait and just try to, we will definitely not forget, I'm sure, in two more episodes, whether he should be here. I'm sure we'll remember.
Yeah. Especially at the end of this episode, like, he is basically going to move the plot forward with Francis here. And like, where are they going from here? Where are they going with this from here? It'll be very, I'm very curious to see. So
yeah,
put a pin in it.
Put a pin in that. I'm just looking at the other categories real quick here. We've already got the Bellamy bouncing around forever. That's done, thank God.
And we already have Bellamy as worst character.
Yeah, he's just poorly written. Mm-hmm. I was really trying to think of something from Lazarus, and I haven't come up with anything yet. I want to nominate something. There isn't like an animation category, so it would definitely fall into that. But that's like maybe. Yeah, we don't even have that category anymore. I don't know why. We have
best looking show.
Oh, best looking show? Oh, okay.
Column F. Yeah.
All right. So. Okay. Well, obviously, we'll be nominated for that.
Yeah. We don't really do nominations for that because it's just kind of all shows. So.
Right. Yeah. I thought the episode was good. And like I said, Lazarus, I thought it was, and you said you think it's the best one so far. I agree with that. I just think that like there's no like outstanding moment from the episode to me like that really sticks out to me. I think it was all very good but not amazing. So, anything else?
No, I don't think so.
All right, well, let's wrap it up there then. So that'll do it for episode 423. Tune in next week when we will cover yet more Lazarus common side effects in One Piece in episode 424. Thank you very much for being here, Seda.
Yep, no problem.
And thanks again for joining us, Crocodile, earlier, although he's already left. And we'll see you next time. And until then, later.